and friends. Of course, I go by the name of the Kid, famous. You and I are tuned into the Tim and Friends Show. Hello, education, entertainment, coast to coast. Ball it up, call it entertainment. Let's get this started. Uncle Tim, let's start this show in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's go.
Welcome, friends. Week 8. Tim and Friends on Sportsnet. I'm Tim McAuliffe coming to you live from the Sportsnet studios in downtown Toronto. Episode 36, I think, and it might be among the more jam-packed editions of the show. Coming up, a tip of the cap to Brooke Henderson. Some Blue Jays talk with Arden Zwelling after 2 of 3 in Tampa in impressive fashion. Padres and Dodgers, thank you, sir. May I have another? Unwritten rules. Do we have a race for fourth in the National Hockey League after all? Did the Leafs prove they won't be pushed around? And ho-hum, the Raptors play 5 times between now and Sunday night. Lions and Tigers and Bears, oh my, this is going to be fun. NHL on Sportsnet analyst Justin Bourne also drops by in the second hour as we get you set for the rare 6:30 Eastern start time on Habs and Flames taking place in Calgary. That's right. The old 4:30 local start. I like it. Home from school? Let's do that hockey. This is a game that a week ago didn't seem like it would mean much. But lo and behold, Calgary wins tonight. And they're 2 points back of Montreal for the fourth and final playoff spot in the North. Don't stop there. Canucks and Sens lock horns in Ottawa. That crazy 7 p.m. local start. Canucks win that and the Flames win. And whoa, doctor. Whoa, doctor. Not only are the Flames 2 points back, but Vancouver would be 6 points back of Montreal with, count them, 5. Bundy, 5 games in hand. Again, think back like a week ago. This seemed crazier than our friend Mark Miller pondering a Super Bowl matchup with the Dallas Cowboys.
Buffalo all the way this time!
All right, I'm sorry. I just love that guy. Take a look at the standings. They're real and they are spectacular. Well, if you aren't a Habs fan. In fact, they're so good, they have inspired me to bring back the POF. That's right, the kind of sort of relevant, but for some reason radically changing percentages on making the playoffs that can help you prove a point, but I'm not exactly sure how they come to these percentages or how they can change so drastically. Ladies and gentlemen, I humbly present for your entertainment purposes only, please no wagering, the return of the POF.
Yes, I cry. Yes, I cry.
POF. 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 So on Friday, Neil Mattias of the Tim and Friends team suggested that it was time for the POF to return. We pondered, we looked at the numbers and what we had lined up for the rest of the show and gave it a meh. A meh. A meh? I mean, I publicly apologize, Neil. In my defense, on Friday, it looked like this. All 4 playoff teams at over 90%. What's the point? The point, Timmy, was if. And yes, the if happened, my friends. 2 Calgary wins over Montreal. And in the immortal words of Nate Dogg in the next episode, hold up. Those numbers from Friday afternoon to Sunday afternoon, 2 days, the Habs went from over 90% to 76%. The Flames went from 2.3% to almost 13%. And what in the good name of Lanny McDonald's mustache happens if they win tonight? Then the car passes your kids playing road hockey. You know what I'm talking about. That's right, kids. Game on. Game on! The POF could have like a 30 to 40 point shift in 4 nights, which is why we called the POF number ridiculous in the first place. But when Murphy's Law hits sports, look out. If only Marc Bergevin didn't use 3 of his 4 emergency call-ups in the first eligible game after the deadline. Wait till Montreal figures that out. Wait to see Montreal re-examine it all if they don't make the playoffs. Win tonight, And it's a deep breath in La Belle Province. Lose again. Gonna get a little hot in Montreal. In fact, real hot. And oh yeah, rookie sensation Cole Caulfield will make his debut for the Habs tonight. In case there wasn't enough whole grain goodness, this is why we love sports. Coming up, live check-ins from Calgary, Ottawa, and Winnipeg, where the Jets are not only dealing with their longest losing streak of the season, amazingly, that's just three games, but they are also dealing with an injury to Nick Ehlers and some Mark Scheifele controversy. I didn't think Mark Scheifele controversy was even possible, but we will examine it at the top of the clock. I know it's not just the NHL races, or race, as it were, reigniting a passion for sports. How about the Dodgers and the Padres?
First things first.
There was no doubt Fernando Tatis Jr. was the story in baseball this weekend, with five home runs in what was an incredibly entertaining series between the Padres and the Dodgers in LA. On Friday, Tatis hit two home runs off of Clayton Kershaw on the 22nd anniversary of his father, Fernando Tatis Sr., and the fifth tenor, hitting two grand slams in the same inning at Dodger Stadium. Something in the water for the Tatises in Chavez Ravine. Oh, but it wasn't done. On Saturday, Tatis homered twice again, this time off Trevor Bauer, becoming the first player in MLB history with back-to-back two home run games against two former Cy Young Award winners. And like many, he had a little something extra for Trevor Bauer.
He hits this one a ton. A leadoff home run for Tatis.
Looked like he points to one eye. Yeah, he hit it with one eye. I wonder if that's a little bit of stirring it up.
Tatis went out and got it, sent it to deep left center, and gone.
He did the one eye thing earlier. Now he does the McGregor strut like Trevor does when he strikes somebody out to end the inning.
Now, you might have thought that those celebrations would have earned a Tatis a fastball in the ribs. But Bauer surprised more than a few people when he was not only not bothered by the celebrations, he actually co-signed them.
He did it in the first. I didn't see it because I was paying attention to doing my job. And then he did it again when he homered off me again later in the game. Their dugout was doing it. And I like it. I think that pitchers who have that done to them and react by throwing at people or, you know, getting upset and hitting people or whatever, I think it's pretty soft. If you give up a homer, a guy should celebrate it, you know. It's hard to hit in the big leagues. So I'm all for it, and I think it's important that, you know, the game moves in that direction and we stop throwing at people because they celebrated having some success on the field.
Stop throwing at people because they're celebrating success on the field. It felt like a momentous occasion that perhaps we reached a tipping point in the game that pitchers have reached the point of acceptance of bat flips and other celebrations without the need for retaliation. It went further. Bauer and Eric Hosmer, also on the Padres if you don't know, also had a back and forth in the game. After Bauer struck out Hosmer in the fourth, he did the imaginary sword celebration. And Hosmer did it back to him after an infield single in the sixth, though it wasn't shown on the broadcast. And Hosmer replied to a tweet with Bauer's post-game comments, writing, "Nothing but respect. Well said, bro." Is it bro or is it brah? Bruh? Bro. You're a bra guy?
A bra is B-R-U-H. So that's bro.
That's bro?
Yeah.
Like, bro, what up, bro?
Exactly.
All right, bro. To which Bauer responded, "Bro, your sword celly on first had me dying. I had to recompose myself before facing the next guy." Oh, my goodness. We had a bromance. Little bro love. And for many, the pronouncement that we were ready to turn the corner on all this nonsense and make baseball great again, just as the moral compass known as Bryce Harper had asked. Make baseball great again. Well, Carl Sir Mix-a-Lot, big butt coming. There was a caveat. after videos surfaced showing Tatis sneaking a peek at Dodgers catcher Will Smith ain't there before his second home run, either looking for the sign, perhaps Smith's positioning. Bauer tweeted, and I quote, "If you need to know what's coming, if you need to know what pitch is coming that badly, just ask Daddy nicely next time. I ain't scared," referring back to the time that he told people what he was going to throw. Tatis came back with a Photoshop of him holding baby Bauer with the caption, "Tranquilo, hijo," which means "calm down, son," in Spanish. Now, listen, Bauer responded again with something he may have to have a hearing from the commissioner's office about, but clearly the suggestion was that Tatis knew what was coming, and that kind of sort of changed Bauer's opinion. Here's what he said in a video posted on YouTube on Sunday, well, because he's Trevor Bauer.
If you're going to do that and celebrate it, I mean, you gotta, that's tough. Either be good enough to not have to look at the signs and then you can celebrate, or if you do have to look at the signs, I don't know about the celebration, man, because like, it's a tough one. Now this brings up the question of unwritten rules, and am I mad about the celebrations and the bat flips and all that stuff? No. However, if you start looking at signs, if you start pulling this like Bush League stuff, that's when people get pissed off. I mean, a lot of people get pissed off about the celebrations and that, whatever, they're just soft. But that's the type of stuff that would get you hit in other games. Now, I'm mild-mannered about it, and you know, I'm gonna send a message more this way and say, hey, that's not okay. If you keep doing it, something will have to happen. But baseball policing itself, this is where it would happen.
So he's okay with the celebrations as long as you're not breaking one of baseball's other unwritten rules. Either way, there is no question we've come a long way from the reaction to Jose Bautista in 2015.
Bautista, only because the thought of him flipping his bat and all the antics that were going on by the Jays, it just seemed out of control and unnecessary. There is no sportsmanship anymore. There is no respect for anything, anybody, anywhere. And now you see kids in Little League, in the Little League World Series, act like little turds.
Little turds have grown up. They are now big turds, and they play in the major leagues. I mean, the Rangers held on to that grudge for years. Hell, Bautista got punched in the face, and Rugies loved and celebrated for it. Man, he should be punching dudes every second game these days if he's worried about bat flips. But let's be honest. Bautista's bat flip may have opened the door, at least started the conversation. And in the 5 years since, those flips have become more and more commonplace. And it's not just the hitters. Now, for the pitchers, the K-strut is a thing. Shout out Pitching Ninja. And I love the K-strut. Is there any difference when a pitcher screams and celebrates walking off a mound? And is any of this bad for baseball? I know we are closer, but how close are we to the point where everyone is good with all of this?
He got it.
And he struck him out. It might have been a little stare down after Baez struck out.
A ball and two strikes to Desmond. Got him on a called strike three.
Tatis, an opposite field shot that he knew from the get-go, and a bat flip.
One ball, one strike. In the air, center field, Correa's watching. This is back, and it's gone! Astros win!
It's through 23 games. And this ball's drilled. Deep left field! Gone! Have all the fun you want, Tim Anderson. This one is done!
Do we all agree with that? Have fun, Tim Anderson. I guess what we're asking here is the code and the unwritten rules that go along with the code, over and done with? Are there still exceptions? Are there still caveats? Are those exceptions, are those caveats, like Bauer mentioned, legit? Let us know at Tim and Friends, as always.
First things first.
All right, let's bring in digital producer Jesse Rubinoff to the equation. This might be an easier said than done thing, but I'm guessing that the vast majority of folks on social media are good with making baseball great again. Like, I think if you just put it to them, like, do you like this stuff? The vast majority will say, we like this stuff.
Do you know something about this? Because we threw up a poll. Okay. And that's pretty much exactly what we asked them. Are you cool with the bat flips, struts, and other celebrations in baseball, like some of what you just saw on the screen? And it's an overwhelming yes. Cool with it all. 91.5%. Only 8.5% say tone it down.
Even more overwhelming than I thought.
Yeah. So, but the thing is, it's a little bit complicated because, as you'll see in some of these replies, people think it's very much dependent on the situation in some cases. Because if you're in the first inning and you hit a homer and you're flipping your bat, maybe the other team's not going to take that.
Let me hear the responses, because I believe herein lies the dilemma, but let me hear it.
So the Brooklyn Hammer says, sure, when the moment calls for it, doesn't need to be after every single home run, strikeout, etc. Chris says, I'm not a Trevor Bauer fan, but he's absolutely right. It's not easy to hit a home run, so good for them for doing it, but it's got to go both ways, so don't be mad if the pitcher struts off the mound or whatever. Imagine how boring basketball would be if they didn't have emotion. And one of the most famous clips of a basketball celebration is when the guy didn't even make the bucket in Nick Young. Like, that's the difference.
Why are you going Swaggy P on?
I'm just saying, like, that he had that reaction, and it's a famous reaction. And it didn't even go in. That just gives you an idea of what the difference is between basketball and baseball.
Rule?
What, celebrating?
Are you upset if a guy celebrates and it doesn't go in?
No, I'm not upset about
anything. You're hanging on to it like 8 years later.
No, I love it. I just think that illustrates the difference between baseball and basketball. Because if someone does something that you don't think the person should be celebrating, it's talked about for weeks. We're talking about it right now. Because Tatis is strutting around third base and strutting at home plate. Baseball just tends to overreact with this stuff. And I think it's time to move into the present here.
Yeah, I think, though, there's a difference between baseball and hockey and football and basketball because of what happens. So the response to it in the past has been 90-mile-an-hour fastball on the ribs. And if you miss on a 90-mile-an-hour fastball to the ribs, it can be a 90-mile-an-hour fastball around the head.
Right.
Right?
It's dangerous, yeah.
And but that's the truth here. Like, it becomes very, very dangerous. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to respond like that, then you up the level of consequences to this heightened spot where nobody wants to be. And the only way to respond to that is with more fire.
Yeah.
And this is why, if you don't know where the line is, then you've got a problem. Do you know what I'm saying by that?
100%. The irony of baseball is that it's so complicated because the code is what leads to the drama between the teams. So people are saying they like the celebrations, but the throwing at guys and the bat flipping and people getting offended is what leads to drama in baseball. And so many, that's what so much of people like about baseball, about the sport, is the drama and the benches clearing. And you only get that when you get the shenanigans and people getting offended by the shenanigans. So it's sort of a catch-22.
Right, so you have to have everyone accept it. And that's why I thought for a second that Bauer saying after the game, I want to see more people accept it. Because that was my problem the entire time with it, is that if not everyone is on board, someone's going to get a fastball to the ribs or worse. And it felt like Bauer was there until he saw the video of Tatis Jr. looking back, maybe peeking at a signal or two. I want to continue the conversation. Arden Zwelling is going to join me next. You guys are already weighing in a ton on Twitter. Keep them coming at Tim and Friends. We'll get to a bunch of them. Still to come, Smoke or Fire, NFL Draft Edition. Michael Lombardi is going to join us. Plus, Justin Bourne in studio. And visits to the rink in Calgary, Winnipeg, and Ottawa ahead of a huge night in the North Division. But up next, we keep that baseball talk going. As mentioned, Arden Zwelling on the unwritten rules. Plus, the Jays win a series in Tampa despite defensive struggles and pitching injuries. Tim and Friends on a Monday coming at you.
Yeah, very well done.
tonight. Perfect.
Welcome back to your winning ways, Brooke Henderson.
0-1 and swing and a ground ball. Diving stop, panic, back to his feet and on to first to get him. Relief pitching bullpens are becoming more and more and more important.
Shout out to the bullpen. Without them, we wouldn't win this game. Shout out to the boys. Let's get it.
Here's a chance for Johnny Gaudreau. Shoots. He scores.
It's right there for us. I think we have a real good shot to make a push here.
Joe Thornton really wants a piece of Nikolaj Ehlers.
He's bringing more fire.
I like the edge in the game. It was right. It was good. I like that.
Tatis with quite a night last night. Two home runs. He hits this one a ton. A leadoff home run for Tatis.
Looked like he points to one eye. Yeah, he hit it with one eye. I wonder if that's a little bit of stirring it up.
I like it. I think that pitchers who have that done to them and react by throwing at people, I think it's pretty soft.
Tatis went out and got it. Sent it to deep left center.
He did the one-eye thing earlier. Now he does the McGregor strut like Trevor does when he strikes somebody out to end the inning.
I'm all for it, and I think it's important that, you know, the game moves in that direction.
90 feet away with one gone, and Manny sends a base hit back up the middle. Tatis scores. This game is tied at 7. The Padres have come all the way back from down 7-1. Hosmer swings and sends a drive to center field. Tatis will score easily, and it's 8-7 San Diego.
Baseball taking the lead here. I read my first co-host long before I met my first co-host. He was writing about the Western University Mustangs. I was stealing his information for my broadcast on the Western University Mustangs, but I did send him a note saying that I thought he was very talented. And I was right. He turned that job into a job at Sportsnet, a beat on the Jays, and one of, if not the best Jays podcast out there, At the Letters with Ben and Nicholson Smith. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Arden Zwelling to the show. What's up, buddy?
I owe it all to you. Thank you. I appreciate that reminder.
Do you remember me reaching out
when
you were writing? Do you?
Yeah. Score days. You and Sid, man. My original supporters. Yeah. Residuals in the mail. Don't worry.
Appreciate it. I haven't got many of those residuals, though. All right. So we were just talking about Dodgers and Padres. I mean, it was an unbelievable series, but then you have the subplots of Tatis, Hosmer. I'm throwing him into the equation. Trevor Bauer. Like, what was your take on all of it?
Which is funny because the last thing we're talking about is the baseball that was played. Right. Yeah. The last thing we're talking about is a pitch or a home. Well, we are in a way talking about a home run. A
couple of home runs, maybe five of them.
We're not really talking about tactics here. Right. And we're not talking about pitch selection. You know, we're talking about struts, and we're talking about people kind of missed the little stutter step into third on the home run trot, too, which I loved, and bat flips. It is interesting how far we've come in just 6 years from Jose Bautista. Remember the national discourse sparked for, you know, years.
We played the Goose Gossage clip.
Yeah, right? So it's funny how far we've come where now you can watch like a Tuesday night game between whoever, right? Like Braves Marlins, and you'll see a bat flip, and nobody's that bothered about it. With this, the personalities of these two has kind of made it a bit more momentous.
Right.
But, you know, bat flipping is becoming a lot more common in the game.
Without a doubt. Every day, I think, if you watched all games, 14, 15, or whatever it is on any given night, you would see a couple of bat flips a night. And I mean real bat flips. And one of our second interactions, we work in different departments, so we don't come across each other a hell of a lot. But do you remember in a newsroom, you and I had a long, drawn-out, passionate conversation about this?
I think it continued over a few conversations.
It did, I believe. And it was about this very thing. And the one caveat I always had was, if everyone doesn't accept it, we're still going to have problems. Do you think we are, how close are we to everyone accepting it? And where is the line drawn? Because that's where I have a problem.
I think we're getting there because I don't know who's against this. Like, other than your grandfather, who is not enjoying this baseball, right? Who's not enjoying Marcus Stroman doing what he's doing and Trevor Bauer? And, like, who is... I don't know who is taking a staunch anti-bat flip stance
at this point. Like, I can't find those people.
Right.
So I think
if you look online, Jesse did a poll for Tim and Friends. What are we at now? We were at 91% before.
Still 91.5%. 8.5. So 8.5% of people participating in the poll.
Yeah.
Don't like bat flips, I guess.
Okay, so is a bat flip at 8-0 in the eighth inning okay?
Yeah, that's different, right? And that's kind of like the running up the score thing. So that does cross a bit of an unwritten rule in the game, I think. Like, yeah, nobody's going to be happy if you are bat flipping off of, you know, the seventh reliever in the game who's just in there to mop up.
Right.
It also matters who does it too, right? Like, I think Tatis has earned his bat flips a bit more than, say, like, I don't think you're going to see Joe Panic bat flipping.
But do you think that the players get that? Like, do you think that the nuance that you're speaking about right now, because I'm with you. Like, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Like, I think there's a difference between Jose Bautista after one of the craziest innings and all of the hate that poured onto that field versus game number 63, 8-0 game, eighth inning. There should be a difference, but telling all the players that is going to be tough to do.
Well, and you see it in the NBA as well. If you're up 30, you're not celebrating the same way if you finish an and one as you would if it's a tight game down the stretch, right? I think you see it in the NFL as well, right? Like, you know, we all understand it's pretty reasonable to understand, like, when you can celebrate pretty wildly and when perhaps it is not the classiest thing to do in the world. But I don't know, look, go watch KBO baseball, man. Those guys are bat flipping walks. Yeah. Those guys are sending their bats to Neptune after.
But I just think that if you did that in Major League Baseball, you're still getting the fastball to the ribs, and it's gonna be a delicate line for a while until everyone figures out what the new unwritten rules are.
People are responding to it, though. Fans are enjoying it.
We're talking about it, right?
And baseball is going to come up to this sort of crossroads at a certain point where they're going to need to start appealing to a younger demographic. Yeah. They're going to need to start making these games shorter. They're going to need to start making them more interesting, more exciting. I mean, this day is coming. There's too many options now for people, for entertainment products, right?
Right.
Like, it's the hyper-connectivity of this world. We can sit here and watch kids in Brazil and Germany playing League of Legends, and people do, right? That option didn't exist in baseball's heyday when, you know, it was just, you flipped on the TV and there's like four things on and one of them was a baseball game. Now with so many options, baseball's got to appeal to that broader, more casual demographic. We're going to be fans forever. We're always going to love this game, but baseball's got to appeal to more people.
I've been trying to tell people who are my age and older. I'm 45. Come after me. I'm a man. But I've been trying to tell people, like, I got kids. Everything that they ever want is on demand.
Yep.
Do you know what that does to a human being? Like, when, maybe you guys are a bad example, but when I was young, I had to wait till Sunday morning to get the programming that was geared towards me, or Saturday morning to get the programming that was geared towards me. And that was the only time that I could ever watch anything that was geared towards me. These kids get it now. And if you're right, if you don't start appealing to them, you've already lost a generation by playing World Series games at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah.
And a kid who, like, my son loves baseball. My son plays baseball. My son's 10 years old. Ask me how many World Series games he's watched start to finish.
Yeah. How many games, period? How many four-hour affairs has he sat through? Period.
Only when he goes.
Right? Yeah.
Only when he goes.
So, like, people don't have time for a full baseball game anymore with the options that they have in today's world. So, baseball's going to have to... I know we're going to talk about the seven-inning no-hitter thing in a bit, but, like, my most, like, I think, unpopular baseball decision, or opinion, excuse me, is that all games should be seven innings. Forever. That you got to take that plunge. It's got to happen. You want to meaningfully shorten up this game and meaningfully make it more interesting and appealing to people? All games should be seven innings.
I think you, it's so interesting to me because, and let's walk the road, who cares? Okay. I'm going to pull up the chair. Because now what you're going to do with seven-inning games, and immediately I'm like, yes, this guy's got it. And then I started thinking about Kevin Cash in a seven-inning game. Like, he's going to use seven pitchers in a seven-inning game.
He might, or he might use one. He might just use Madison Bumgarner, right? Like, I don't know. Tanner Roark could go seven innings. We've seen it. Right, Hyunjin Ryu goes seven innings all the time. If anything, you might get fewer pitching changes.
I honestly think that if you gave managers and the analysts, I think there's going to be, and me, you and I might disagree on this. So let's we'll tackle this and then get back to seven. Do you not think there's going to be a pushback on just how analytically driven baseball is? Like, we had a conversation with Ross Atkins, and something clicked in my head when I asked him if he thought that all of the power out of the bullpen and all of the emphasis on velo was causing more injuries to pitchers. And he said, well, that's something that we're going to have the give and take on and try and figure out. And I thought, all this analytics, like, there is going to be a point where analytics pushes back on its own analytics, where it says some things are being overanalyzed a little too much, and we have to just pull back. Do you think that'll happen?
The new market inefficiency is soft tossers? Is that the idea?
Yeah, like or that someone will figure out that all of this shifting, in the end, someone will figure out how to hit the other way, and all the shifting will stop.
It's hard to hit the other way when everyone's throwing 98 with, you know, Trevor Bauer's breaking stuff,
it
right?
It should be easier to hit the other way when people are throwing 98.
It should be easier?
To go the other way?
It's harder.
Yeah, because you don't have to pull it. You don't have to get it in front of it.
It's harder to hit that stuff, to square that up, especially when a guy's got multiple pitches.
Anyone who played with me knows that all I did was go the other way as a left-handed batter.
What's and the try hardest and beat pitch you faced?
Yeah, about 70.
You know, right?
Yeah, about 70.
So, I don't know. I think if you moved to 7 innings, you'd have fewer injuries. You'd have fewer pitchers.
No, I get you with all that.
You know? I think if you shorten the season even. Like, I got all kinds of crazy ideas, Tim, right?
I think
7-inning games. I think, you know, 142-game season, 140. Every Monday should be an off day league-wide.
And listen, baseball already ruined the record book. So for anyone yelling out there, here's the record book. Yeah. What are you doing? It changes, you know, whatever you're taught. 300 wins is never going to happen again. The home runs are never going to happen again unless we start juicing the ball even more. But that's a different story for a different day. The baseball record book means very, very little these days.
Cal Ripken's record will never fall. But we're also not taking away your precious record book. Like, traditionalists, like the stodgy, you know, conservative orthodoxy people, we're not taking it away. You can still have your record book and you can still enjoy your old games. We are admitting and, like, realizing that A, the athletes today are different, and the game today is different, and it's played harder and faster, and it's more demanding on the body. And we're also understanding that you need an audience, and you don't want baseball to become horse racing or to become boxing, and to not change and adapt and evolve as time goes on to continue to be as popular as it is today. Before the pandemic, attendance was going down, viewership going down. Young people are not as interested in this game as they are in other sports.
Without a doubt.
And people want to be, and you need to do something about that.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Then do I know your answer on whether or not Madison Bumgarner's 7-inning no-hitter was a no-hitter?
Of course it was. Of course. And if you want to be like asterisk police, you can. I'll give you your brackets with a 7 around it after the no-hitter. If you really like need that to sleep at night, fine. Of course it was a no-hitter. Coming into the game, they agreed this game will be 7 innings. And he pitched 7 innings, and he did not give up a hit.
Right.
How is that not a no-hitter? If a pitcher loses a no-hitter in the 10th inning, which we have seen pitchers lose no-hitters in the 10th inning.
Yeah.
Why isn't that a no-hitter then? If all of a sudden we have this 9-inning stipulation.
Well, it's
that
not like 9 innings is arbitrary. Like,
no, but there's nothing in the rules of what a no-hitter is that says it has to be 9 innings, because we've seen pitchers lose no-hitters in the 10th.
Right.
So, of course, it's 9-hitter.
We've also seen guys like Dave Steeb. Like, as a Jays fan growing up, you see the Dave Steeb one-hitters that would have been a no-hitter under this. But I'm conflicted because there was no hitters left to face for Madison Bumgarner.
Yeah.
But he
would have gone back out and kept pitching.
And he was also at 98 pitches. So he had to go 2 more innings and would have been at what? Like, what are we talking? 2 more innings.
Depends how efficient he was going to be, right?
Yeah, a couple depends of three pitch innings.
Depends how risky he was going to get. Start pumping, you know, fastballs down the middle or what, you know? So I don't see why it wouldn't be a no-hitter. I don't know who takes joy in trying to remove that accomplishment from him.
Here's the... I agree with you to a certain... Like, almost all the way. If the PA and the league sit down and agree we're going to play 7-inning games, then everyone's agreed this is a 7-inning game. And if you no-hit, if you have 3 home runs, whatever you do in that 7-inning game, it's an official Major League Baseball game because it was agreed upon.
It wasn't stopped because of weather, you know, because of rain or because of like a pack of hornets or something. It was they.
There were no more batters left to face.
We gave out Cy Young awards last year in a 60-game season.
Right.
Nobody said anything about that.
And MVPs.
That wasn't a problem for anybody.
Yeah, without a doubt. And but I would put the asterisk beside it.
Well, like I said, I'll give you bracket, open bracket 7, close bracket. Right. I'll give you that in the record books if it means that much to you.
We have a few members of our team that are pissed right now. Like, very mad. Like, I suggested that it was okay earlier on the weekend.
Yeah.
And just the WhatsApp conversation was like, are you kidding me? All right, we're going to take the break. Arden, can you stick around?
Of course.
Talk some Jays.
Yeah.
Plenty of hockey talk ahead. 3 in the North tonight, very important. But after the break, Jays, speaking of 3, took 2 of 3 in Tampa. But Jays fans still worried about injuries and defense. All right. 1-0 win, injuries and defense. Got it, Gooden, since you understood more with Arden next. And I get it. Trust me, I get it. Tim and Friends includes Arden's Welling. I don't even know how many times in a year could we have had you in to talk Jays and then decided to go other baseball first?
Yeah.
Like not in Canada.
Often. Right. And that conversation continued into the break, by the way. Like, we didn't stop talking about it.
No, not at all. All three of us.
I'm not even just saying that. We just kept that going through the break.
Yeah. It is amazing.
It's good to be fired up about baseball. It's good to be passionate. It's good to have a little piss and vinegar in the game.
Right.
It's nice.
And it's good to have a couple of disagreements here and there over what unwritten rule is legit and what unwritten rule is garbage, and let's get out of it. Yeah. And I don't know why people are afraid of it. Well, I do know why. It's 2021, and you have to take one side or the other and yell about it and forget every piece of nuance that takes place. All right, let's talk about the Jays. 2-3 in Tampa. Is there more excitement over a 1-0 win in Tampa that gives you a series in what has been a little shop of horrors for the Jays or concern for Hyunjin Ryu?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, Hyunjin Ryu's downplaying it, right? So I guess that kind of assuages the concern a little bit. I mean, we'll see. This is part of the Hyunjin Ryu experience, as we know. I mean, you can go back and look at the injury history with the Dodgers. I mean, his year before free agency was great, but prior to that, glute issues, groin issues, shoulder issues, neck issues. I mean, he just, you know, it's just something that he's battled throughout his career. So I don't know. There's obviously a negative to that. And the positive to that is that he knows what he needs to do to get through it. And hey, he pulled himself from the start when he knew he had to. So let's see how he looks his next time out. I think the flip side of what you're saying there is that people haven't seen the Blue Jays win games like that at the Trop.
No.
That doesn't happen.
Yeah,
like, that's not how it goes.
That was my thought process the entire time as I watched back on my PVR.
Yeah, right. It was just
They're not going to win this game 1-0.
No, surely not.
No.
Right? Like, surely, Delise is going to blow it, or Chadwick's going to blow it, or something's going to be a defensive miscue, and the Blue Jays won it 1-0. Which gets back to really, like, I know everybody's talking about the defense with this team, and it is to me like completely missing the plot of the fact that the team's not scoring. And the team's not hitting at all. Like, that is the fatal flaw of this club right now, and that is why they will not be successful if they do not turn that around. They need to score, and they have not been. You're not going to win a lot of 1-0 games in 2021 MLB. The amount of homers that are hit nowadays, you're not going to protect those one-run leads.
Okay, so then many fans are looking to George Springer and his presumptive return tomorrow.
I think he'll be back.
The tonic that could cure this.
Yeah.
Is that asking too much, or can slotting people into their right positions maybe give a jump start to this offense?
I think it'll be a spark. Yeah. I think it'll help. I mean, he's chomping at the bit, man. He wanted to play opening day, you know, like 2 injuries ago, he wanted to play. So he's ready to go. So I would expect he's going to hit the ground running when he comes back. It does just deepen the lineup. And I think, you know, you see Bo Bichette pressing a little bit at the plate. You saw on Sunday Vlad pressing for the first time. Like, that was concerning, that he looked like 2020 Vlad again, expanding, like swinging a little too hard, not letting the game come to him. Mm-hmm. So if those guys can just kind of settle in and do what they're good at, George Springer at the top of the lineup, hitting leadoff, is kind of setting the tone, I think it'll help.
But it's going to take, and this is maybe I've just listened to Joe Siddle too much, and you can argue with Joe.
There's no such thing.
Yes.
You can't.
But it's going to take a while for the guy to jump into major league I know he's been taking batting practice. Yeah. I know, but it's going to take a while, is it not?
Look, you're adding like one of the best players in baseball. Like this isn't just like the, you know, this isn't the same as waiting for Lourdes Gurriel Jr. to come around, right, and to hit his hot streak. This is adding George freaking Springer.
Right.
You know, like this is adding like one of the top offensive contributors in the game. So I expect it to be impactful. And hey, Teoscar Hernandez won't be far behind him. All of a sudden, you know, maybe a little bit of playing time competition could help as well.
Right.
Start running that meritocracy. Guys have to earn their plate appearances, which is always a good thing. That can motivate players as well. It's hard for me to paint George Springer's return as any kind of a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be. I wonder if there's too much pressure on him to jump in and be George Springer immediately.
That's what the $25 million are for.
Yeah, because they need him to be George Springer immediately because no one else is doing George Springer-like things.
That's what the money's for. That's that's what that is for.
Understood.
For George Springer to do George Springer thing. That's why we're paying you that.
Even if he's coming off an injury and hasn't played a game yet.
That's what the money's for.
Jump in and do it, kid. All right, so let's talk about that defense a little bit because there is this conversation that keeps taking place around do you move any of these pieces to make them feel more comfortable or put less pressure on them? And mainly we're talking about the left side of that infield with Bo Bichette and Kevin Biggio. How do you see that?
So those are separate discussions.
Okay.
Bo Bichette, who we are looking at right now, is going to be the Blue Jays shortstop for the rest of the season, and he should be. This is like a cornerstone franchise piece, one of the most important players on this team, and there is so much sweat equity that has been put into him at shortstop, like not just this season, not just this spring, in 20, in 19, and 18, since he was like an 18-year-old coming out of high school with this club, or actually he was homeschooled, so with Dante. So like he is staying there. You are so committed to that. Kevin Biggio, like I can understand if you're going to, dial back the amount of third base that he plays, but you still don't exactly have a great alternative there. Is it going to be Joe Panik or Santiago Espinal? I mean, you're going to take an offensive hit doing that. Is it going to be Vladimir Guerrero Jr. moving over to third base?
That's what I was going to say next.
Okay. The worst third baseman in baseball, the last time he consistently played the position. That's your answer. And, by the way, you finally got it.
That was Fat Vladdy. This is Slim Vladdy.
Okay, and you finally got him sorted out, though. You finally got him in a place where he's comfortable, and he's playing first base, he feels good, he's confident, and it's transferring to the plate. Do you really want to jeopardize that?
Nope, you're not doing that, no.
So look, Jordan Groshans will be the Blue Jays' third baseman someday, or Austin Martin will be the Blue Jays' third baseman someday. That day is just not today.
Right.
And right now, the Blue Jays have to roll through with these two. I know I'm kind of alone on Patience Island on this one, right? And like I know people are jumping off the good ship, rational and reasonable, but I'm staying afoot here through 21 games.
Which is interesting for you. And I said to Jesse and Joe, Joe was in here, and I go, listen, I know we're going to have this conversation every time Bo Bichette makes an error. We're going to go on national TV. We're going to have the Bo. Can we just say he's playing shortstop for the entire year? The Jays need to know what he is and what he is going to be, and he's going to stay there. Let's not do this thing where we go every time, oh, he looks good. Oh, he made an error. Oh, he has less errors than Fernando Tatis Jr. Like, everyone, it's just, we're going to have this for a year, calm down, and yet here I am asking you after game 21, are they going to move them? Because everyone's talking about it.
It's also 2021. Defense has never been less important in this game. The ball has never been in play less, and there have never been fewer defensive opportunities than there are now.
I do feel like sometimes it's like when the goalie in hockey lets in a bad goal.
Yeah.
Like you look at the numbers, and if he stops 35 at 36, someone goes, well, he had a really good game. But if that one goal was deflating or a big goal or it alters an inning that could have been something, like you know how that goes in baseball. I just feel like defense is always going to be important. And I think we saw a little bit of that in the postseason last year.
Well, and I bet you that goalie's team didn't score a bunch of goals.
Right.
And the Blue Jays are not scoring a bunch of runs, which is why we're talking about defense right now, because they're not scoring runs.
40 seconds left. I know you're a big UFC guy. What the hell happened this weekend?
Kamaru Usman continued to prove, I mean, he is modern day GSP is what happened.
Yes.
You talk about unpopular opinions of mine. Like, I think he is every bit as impressive as GSP in that division. What he's doing as a wrestler now, knocking out some of the best boxers on the planet. Unbelievable.
Why are we having such good cards?
I don't know. It's a good question. I think the level of competition is higher. The matchmaking is really solid.
Maybe they figured out matchmaking at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question, but the cards have been, Jesse can tell you, the cards have been great.
Well, Jesse, were you 3-0 on the weekend?
3-0.
Oh, see, not kids? All you got to do is watch Tim and Friends. We got you covered. 3-0 on the weekend. One underdog?
Rose Namajunas.
There you go.
Kick to the head. Lights out.
Ninja.
Appreciate it, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, Arden's Welling. After the break, we head to Calgary, Winnipeg, Ottawa. Three games in the North, plus Justin Bourne in studio. Could the Habs blow this? Next on Tim and Friends. Thank you very much. Sheepdogs back here for hour number two on Tim and Friends. Still to come, Michael Lombardi ahead of the NFL draft, plus Justin Bourne in studio. Why? Big night. Scotia North Division. Three games all on Sportsnet regionally. We'll get to Ottawa and Winnipeg momentarily, but the game of the night comes your way at 6:30 Eastern. I'm not wearing my watch today, and I went to look at my watch, but I don't have it on, so that's 6:30 Eastern. On Sportsnet West, Habs and Flames from Calgary. That's 4:30 local, kids. Calgary has beaten them two straight and have the chance to pull within 2 points tonight for the final playoff spot in the division. Now, it was confirmed a short time ago, Cole Caulfield, Hobie Baker Award winner, will make his NHL debut for the Habs tonight. Here's Coach Dominic Ducharme.
He's going to be on a power play. The amount of minutes is, you know, if I had a crystal ball right now, I could tell you, but we'll see. We're happy to have him in, but it's on the 20 guys at our address. It's not on Cole.
Sebastian, come on, Deton, panic. Oh, it's panic. That's how you say panic in French. We'll see if it works out that way. With more on tonight's game, Let's head live to Calgary and check in with Eric Francis. He gave me these eyes. He was like, what the hell are you talking about? Panic is the same thing. Say panique. Eric, what do you make of the decision to bring Caulfield into the lineup? I mean, you knew he was going to play soon, but now it just seems like an interesting spot.
I love it. This is a team that's on its heels right now. You know, they won three of their last 11 games. They're reeling right now. They need some injection of energy, whatever the case may be. And I know Ducharme kind of downplayed it and said it's not on Cole Caulfield. And I'm not suggesting it is, but it sure can help to get a bit of a shot in the arm when it's your most important game of the season. You know, the Flames have been playing their most important game of the season for a long time now. Montreal's only finally figuring, wow, we better figure this out real soon. Listen, the Flames have seven different players who have scored multiple goals against Montreal in this series. Montreal's got one, Tyler Toffoli. He's got five goals in this head-to-head series, which the Flames have dominated throughout the season. And nobody else has scored more than one. So they need someone who can score goals. They've had a problem with it. Why not put him in? And he just did his rookie skate around there. I always love that. It gives me goosebumps when you see it live. No bucket. This kid's got a lot of confidence. And he went in there without any bucket, skated, buried all three of his shots, and then the rest of them joined him on the ice. They're pretty pumped for him.
Daryl Sutter said after the back-to-back wins, what was the mood in the locker room? What was the mood in the dressing room? He said tired. They just went through back-to-back. Is there some belief in that back-to-back now that we've seen these two straight wins to get within four?
Oh, yeah. I think the Calgary Flames have got that swagger. You know, over the years, we've seen them go on big, long winning binges when they do have that confidence. And, you know, they've won three of five. I mean, it's not remarkable, but it's a situation where right now, they've won five of seven. But it's a situation where right now, this is the only one that matters right now. They feel good about themselves. All these games against Montreal, especially the last four, have all been really, really close. And in all four cases, the team that lost hit a crossbar or a post at some point in time that could have turned the game the other way. So it's flip a coin, boys. Both teams are going to play desperate. Both teams know that this is so important. And simply put, if the Flames lose, their season is over. Montreal's not quite in that situation, but they're getting awfully close, and they know they've got to turn things around quickly.
It felt, last one here, but it felt like the Flames season was already over. Was there a switch hit? Was there an ease in the room when they felt like they were done? Was there a let's go, boys? Like, have you noticed a different urgency? What's been the difference?
The difference is Montreal keeps losing. I mean, that's what kept them in this race. And it all came down to, you know, they kept looking ahead at the schedule and seeing, well, we do play Montreal three in a row there. And if we sweep them, you know, that could make up a whole bunch of ground. So that's really been the difference, that Montreal hasn't done what we thought they would have done, which is even playing 500 hockey, and this game wouldn't have meant a single thing. But the Flames believe, you know, after winning two very important games, they believe that there's really no problem with their team right now. Markstrom's playing well. They're scoring enough goals. Defensively, they're sound. And the biggest difference, I guess, if you ask for a difference, Johnny Gaudreau and Sean Monahan have had a real hard time fitting into Daryl Sutter's new system, have finally figured out a way to be contributing offensively. And they've got the game-winning goals in each of the last two.
To quote Drake from the previous song, we'll see if the Flames run away and they can continue and make this even tighter. And then we'll check the puck tomorrow. Always great catching up with you. Thanks for doing this, Francis.
Hope you find your watch.
There is Eric Francis in Calgary. It's just one of those things in a pandemic you don't usually put on. All right, eventful afternoon in Winnipeg, and we've got word that Nick Ehlers will be out for the rest of the regular season after the collision with Jake Muzzin on Saturday night. Now, head coach Paul Maurice said that they are confident and hopeful that Nick Ehlers will be back for the playoffs. He is currently second on the team in scoring behind Mark Scheifele, who also made some news at practice today. Let's head to Sean Reynolds with more live in Winnipeg. Sean?
Yeah, Tim, you were talking to Eric Francis, and he was talking about Cole Caulfield being the shot in the arm that the Montreal Canadiens needed. Well, this was not the shot in the arm that Nikolaj Ehlers or the Winnipeg Jets needed. Losing him at this crucial juncture is a really big deal. If you've been watching this team this season, covering them like I have, from the outside, I think a lot of people think Connor Hellebuyck has been this team's MVP, maybe Mark Scheifele up in the top 10 in scoring. No, it's Nick Ehlers who has been the MVP for this team, and losing him at this time, right in the middle of a battle for second, as the Edmonton Oilers come rolling into town. The Jets, they've lost three straight games, trying not to make it four. And to add to that bad timing is, as you mentioned, Mark Scheifele's situation, benched in the last game against the Toronto Maple Leafs. He talked about that today and clearly was not happy about it.
You're definitely pretty pissed off. You know, I understand where he was coming from, but like I said before, like I didn't agree with it.
What are we doing out of this, guys?
You know, at the time it took place, and you know, the magnitude of the game. So, you know, I definitely didn't agree with it. So, you know, we'll leave it at that.
How would you describe, I guess, conversations with a player? Not specifics, obviously, but just the importance of the communication with a player, especially a player of his stature, after something like that.
I would describe them as private, and then, you know, necessary, constructive, and over.
Sean, can you hear us still?
I could hear you.
Nice.
Yeah. So if we want to talk about bad timing and how it has to do with this, I mean, Adam Lowry is out of this lineup as well. That is an absolutely huge hit. He's like a key tenet of why this team does so well when they are doing what they're doing. I think you saw in that last game against the Toronto Maple Leafs an example of what they look like after losing that. So now to lose Nikolaj Ehlers on top of that, it is a very challenging moment in the season for the Winnipeg Jets as they're trying to right the ship heading into the playoffs, Tim.
Always great. Live television. Appreciate you, buddy. Be well.
See ya.
There is Sean Reynolds in Winnipeg. The Canucks enter the night 8 points back of the Habs for fourth, but they have five games in hand, so the math says they definitely have a shot, too. Canucks and Sens on Sportsnet Pacific regionally tonight. Let's head to Ottawa and check in with Kyle Bukauskas. So, Kyle.
Yeah, Tim, you mentioned the math, and certainly
part of the equation for the Vancouver Canucks is the compressed schedule for them the rest of the way. 15 games in 24 days, starting here tonight in Ottawa. You know, Travis Green said this morning that, you know, he's talked to his group about the big picture, but he also wants them to approach it like a playoff series where you're not thinking ahead to game four or game five, but just the one that's in front of you. Braden Holtby is going to start for the Canucks here tonight, and rightfully so. He is 11-0-1 in his last 12 career starts versus the Senators. That's encouraging. What was a bit of a concern, though, was the fact that Thatcher Demko suffered a lower body injury during the skate here this morning. Now, Green said it's just day-to-day. They hope it is a minor issue for Demko. On the other side, for the Ottawa Senators, the injury bug has bitten their goaltenders once again. Anton Forsberg got hurt doing his off-ice warm-ups before the game on Saturday. He can't go. Matt Murray got hurt midway through that game on Saturday. It's up in the air whether or not he returns again this season. And so Marcus Hogberg will get the start here tonight, his first start since April the 7th. Philip Gustafson will serve as his backup for Ottawa tonight, Tim.
Thank you very much, Kyle. And crappy, just as Murray was finding his stride in a terrible season after being picked up. It's just tough timing. Thanks, buddy. Always appreciate your time.
Good to be with you.
There is a friend, Kyle Bukauskas. The Leafs' Frederik Andersen was back on the ice this morning. It is the first time he has taken part in a full practice since March 19th. Leafs would have to do some salary cap juggling, stop me if you've heard this before, to activate Andersen before the playoffs.
Getting up to speed again, I think that's the first challenge is when you don't skate and see pucks for a bit, that's the final thing is like when you feel up to speed again, it's the deciding factor. And I think, that's what I still have some time to get up to speed again and hopefully see some game action before the playoffs.
Game action before the playoffs. Joining me to help you get set for a busy night and beyond is a guy who isn't afraid of a strong opinion, former NCAA standout and pro who grew up around the game and footsteps of the 80s Islanders. Did you chuckle? Ladies and gentlemen, Justin Bourne. Welcome back, buddy.
Like, bringing up my playing resume to give me any sort of credibility at all is pretty futile,
I'm going to be honest. It's better than Jesse and I's. All right? This room.
It's not the highest bar to clear here, but I'm happy. I'm over it anyway.
Not exactly. So let's start with where we finished there. Freddie Andersen, is that news that he wants to come back and get some time in?
Yeah, you know, I can't help but feel like, is he in a position to put some pressure on the team there and say, like, I don't want to just show up in playoffs? Like, everything feels a little cap gymnastics-y. I was encouraged not to say the word circumvention, so we'll say gymnastics-y. But it does feel like he's a guy who's going to want to get in before the end of the regular season. He's not going to want to go in cold. And I think they're in a position where, you know, they've got enough points built up on everyone else that they might have to do something weird for the last game or two of the year where they bring up a bunch of AHL guys, send a bunch of guys down, just do some weird math stuff to have a weird roster for the final game or two just to make sure he gets in the net.
Cap manipulation, can we go there?
Yeah, it's still a little harsh. It's pretty direct. Cap massaging, maybe?
Yes, some cap. Well, we all know what's going on here, and the NHL knows what's going on, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think they're overly fond of it. There's been some mention already of trying to stop teams from using LTIR the way that they are. But for now, you're the Leafs. This is a way to, you know, maximize your roster. Tampa Bay is going to have Nikita Kucherov come back in playoffs, so it's not like they're alone in trying to juice their roster for the playoffs.
No, and as we see Montreal do the, I mean, they're playing 11 forwards because they're didn't do it properly.
Like, and you need a guy like Brandon Pridham because Vegas played a game with 16 players at some point this season.
Right.
Just because the cap it's a flat cap. Everyone's up against it. So sometimes you got to get weird.
Without a doubt. Before we get into tonight, I'm curious. Actually, let's talk about tonight and then we'll get into this later. The Calgary Flames, if they win tonight, could change the complexion of this entire division. Is that hyperbole or the truth?
No, it is the truth. The Flames, there's actually a chyron from Sportsnet that Justin Bourne has lost a lot of money on the Flames this year because I've talked about this. I like their roster, so I bet on them a bunch early in the season when they were losing. So, you know, it's one of those, you know, fool me once, fool me 38 times, whatever it is at this point. But they have a good team. And their lack of success this year has been really befuddling for me this season. So for them to turn things around now, I mean, teams do it after 40 games. St. Louis Blues turned things around after 40-some games and won a Stanley Cup just a couple seasons ago.
Right.
So maybe the Flames are turning it around and they're the real deal, which really would change things for likely the Toronto Maple Leafs in the first round if they're coming up against a team that's hot and rolling versus whatever it is the Canadians are doing right now.
Yeah, what is it that the Canadians are doing right now?
Not scoring goals. Yeah. Not at all. So you know what they need? Someone who does.
Cole Caulfield.
The man.
Dun, dun, dun.
The man right there with no bucket and warm-up. How confident.
So this is like, when he said that, I was like, is that an inside hockey thing? Like, do we have to explain the no bucket? Because right now, this is him live on the ice in Calgary, or at least somewhat close to live on the ice in Calgary because they're playing at 6:30. And they sent him out for his rookie. We've seen it 1,000 times where you let the rookie go out alone. And he went out sans bucket.
Yeah.
Is that a little inside hockey? Do we have to talk about that or a little inside baseball?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like one of those things where if you have great flow and you'd love to show it, back in the day, guys just used to let it out there and let it, you know, it looked great, but it's not very safe. You get pucks off the crossbar all the time. The way guys fire the puck now, it's not a great idea. So I bet the boys thought it was funny to let him go no bucket, have the trainer bring it out after, and what a moment, right? Go out there, just feel the hair blowing in the breeze like you're on a pond. Oh. Glorious. I hope he shakes it out. Give us a shake.
Well, you can see all the boys, too, smiling with him. And so Cole Caulfield. Listen, Montreal is not the easiest place to jump in, especially when they're struggling to score goals. And it might be a little bit different because they're in Calgary. And even when they're in Montreal, there's going to be no crowd. But it feels like this is a high-pressure spot to throw this kid into. But if his debut in Laval was anything... maybe a harbinger of things to come elsewhere. It feels like, bucket off, he's up to the task.
Yeah, then everything you read about the kid talks about his confidence. He's clearly unafraid. But, you know, it's almost one of those things where you put the kid in every situation and he scores. Like, can you just keep pushing him up until he doesn't anymore? Let's find out his ceiling. So this makes perfect sense. I talked to Bob McGill today, and he said that watching his first couple games in the AHL was like electric. Like, he is a different player. So this kind of reminds me of Nick Robertson going in for the Leafs in playoffs last year, though, where you smell the desperation. It's like, things aren't working. We don't have other options. This guy is going to score. We need it to be today. Maybe it isn't, but we need, you know, just cross your fingers and hope. So, but they are desperate and they can't pretend they're not. So put him in, see what he can do.
Vancouver Canucks are in Ottawa, as Kyle Bukauskas told us. And they're in a situation where if they win tonight, they're also in the equation, especially if Calgary gets a victory over Montreal. This one is really interesting to me because, you know, we were pumping the tires heading into their return to play, and it felt like it was just the right thing to do given what they were going through and given what they are going to be asked to do. But to now be here and it still be a story is a testament to Travis Green and what they're doing there.
Yeah, no, it really is. And by the way, he's a guy without a contract for next season, which still feels a little bit ridiculous. But you know, there's something uniting about going through a hard time together and coming out the other side. I don't know if you and your buddies ever got in a big fight at the same time, but like, it happens on the ice, like in hockey too. You get in like a bench clearing brawl and everyone comes in the dressing room and all of a sudden you're closer than you've ever been, or maybe a night at the pub, whatever it may be. And I feel like the Canucks kind of went through that, like some sort of uniting thing where this was terrible for everyone. It sucked.
Right.
And we pulled through and we beat the Leafs twice. All of a sudden we're in the playoff picture. Like, they're playing Ottawa tonight too, and no disrespect to Ottawa, but not the strongest team. There's momentum going on in Vancouver. Do I think they're going to make the playoffs? Not a chance. but there's momentum, and you would love for it to happen. I would be cheering for them all the way if they could get close.
The Saturday night headlines and Chris Johnson suggesting that Elias Pettersson might not return this season puts a real damper on whatever hopes they have, especially when you're playing this condensed schedule.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of Canucks fans that are going, look what we did without Pettersson, a record without him. Imagine once he comes back. But they had some luck along the way. Their advanced numbers, if you will, in Pettersson's absence have just been atrocious, like near the bottom of the league in pretty much everything. So they have got good goaltending, good shooting percentages. It's gone well in his absence, but they need him to be a stronger team.
I was going to go Leafs. We're going to save that for the next block.
Hey, man, you do whatever it is you want to do.
Can you hear the wheels turning?
Smoke coming out of your ears.
Yeah. We were talking about unwritten rules in the first two segments of the show, basically. The code slash unwritten rules. Is there an unwritten rule in hockey that you would like to see written?
Yeah. There should, you should, like, let's say you snow the goaltender, you know, Tkachuk sprayed the goalie the other day. You should just have to stand at center ice, take one punch, and just have it be over with. let's not ruin the whole game, make it a circus. Everyone's chasing each other around. You just got to stand there and wear one right in the chin.
It's so funny. I thought you were going to say 2 minutes for unsportsmanlike conduct. Nah. Like, call the penalty on the ice.
No, give him
2 minutes for unsportsmanlike. No, have him stand at center ice and just take a punch.
And you know what? I guess the inverse of that is when you hit your own goaltender in the head in warm-up, they should just dress someone from the press box. Oh, you got to go.
Yeah, you
gotta don't
go.
Get to play that night.
Jesse, look at Jesse, the goaltender.
Oh, yeah.
Do you still play goalie in beer league?
No.
No, you don't. Anymore. You stop playing.
No one plays goalie in my head.
Yeah.
No one plays goalie in beer league because everyone's like, "Why am I still doing this?" All goalies want to play out.
I'm the only idiot. I'll play indoor soccer goalie in beer league.
Do you get shots? Is there action?
You get. It's terrible. You have no mask. It's stupid.
Well, you're long and lean and limber. You look like you're.
It's idiotic. It might be the stupidest thing I've ever done. But I still do it. Well, at least not in pandemic times. More hockey talk on the way ahead of the Flames and Hockey Central. Three games in the North to tee up. Plus some Leafs talk. Justin Bourne, are the Leafs proving they're not going to be pushed around? We'll discuss that next on Tim and Friends. Don't answer now. Wait. For a lot of you watching on TV, Hockey Central is just around the corner. Justin Bourne in studio here on Tim and Friends. And before the break, I asked you if the Leafs were pushing that we weren't going to get shoved around anymore. Mm-hmm. And I go back to them dressing Scott Sabourin against the Calgary Flames and watching him fight Milan Lucic. Now, that was his only role,
right.
So it's not as if he's been around to do it. But since then, it feels like there has been an internal push within that team to prove that they won't be that club again. Have you seen the same thing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Connor Hellebuyck in his interview after the game yesterday said, like, that looks like their playoff form, you know, like what they're going to look like in the postseason. You know, what it reminds me of is, like, if someone wraps you up in a bear hug, you know, you might take the first 5-10 seconds, see if they're going to let you go, and then you start wriggling around and trying to get out of it. And in the past, when the team has been contained offensively, they just kind of let it happen. They sit there and just get hugged. And this team is pushing, they're wriggling, they'll punch you in the face back there. They're desperate to get out of tight games. I love what's happening because there's a typical way teams are going to say, we're going to play the Leafs in playoffs, hit them, smother them, interfere with them, and there's going to have to be this edge we're seeing to get through that. So it's a really positive development.
You know, it's funny because Matthews got hit hard and people wondered where the response was. Tavares got hit hard by Zach Cassian. People wondered where the response was. Even on the knee-on-knee hit on Zach Hyman, where everyone was up in arms, there was no response. It seems as though whatever was brewing with the Maple Leafs, it has kind of sort of come to a head over the last little while. And for me, that Saturday game, and it wasn't just Thornton and Ehlers, because that's Ehlers isn't the guy that's really going to shove you around, but it was just the attitude. And for me, like, and I'm on the outside looking in, I didn't even play NCAA, okay? But for me, sometimes when your big guys start pushing back, even the little guys feel a little more emboldened.
Yeah, I definitely think there's something to that. I also just love that if you're not going to score, do something.
Right.
And there is depth to this lineup that there hasn't been. And, you know, Sheldon Keefe talked about Joe Thornton and saying he's loved his fire from him lately. And the way that he's not just when he's on the ice, but when he's on the bench and when he's in the room. Like, this is not he's not there enjoying this cool time getting to wear the Maple Leaf because he's from Ontario. Like, this is a year to win a Stanley Cup for this team. And you can see everyone sort of embrace that as a mission internally. And with that, you know, sometimes you get a little into the game and upset. And I think it's a healthy thing. I love seeing Austin Matthews go at a guy who hit John Tavares last game. It's a healthy thing for a team showing this level of competitive spirit.
Do you feel like that's real and it'll show up in the postseason?
I do. And I do feel like it's real only because it's not Mitch Marner punching a guy in the face after the whistle trying to say, look, coach, we care. It's guys within the play, a Joe Thornton guy who would normally play like that. You can see it kind of spilling over into multiple shifts, coming out of the box and going back at a guy. There's an authenticity to it that doesn't seem, by the way, people do fake it. I did it all the time. You know, coach, we're down 4 goals. Someone get out there and I got to face wash some guy and get back to the bench. But no, this is happening within the play, and it feels authentic.
Because let's not forget, and listen, I'm not trying to paint this is a new Leafs team, and this is what they're going to be. No. It was Jason Spezza who had to fight for this team in the postseason last year, yeah. Right? Like, that's how far they've come, and I think that was not only a lesson to management, because they've obviously made some changes, but it might have been a lesson to some of the guys in that room.
Yeah.
Like, if you want this that bad, yeah, it can't be the 40-year-old guy going out there to fight.
No, and it is funny that they got older players, but players who had that passion and that desperation, like Spezza. You know, Wayne Simmonds is a guy who we know loves that sort of side of the game. And when I talk about authentic, like, he wants the game to go that way.
Right,
you know, like, right, that's when he's at his most effective. And, you know, Zach Bogosian is another, like, guy who's just not an imposter. So
right,
I think they just feel comfortable that they have players who can play, and if it gets that way, they're going to be okay. But at the end of the day, your point is the most salient, that just this is, they're not, that's not who they are.
Right.
They're still the high-flying guys who want to score goals, and they don't want to do that. But it's just nice that if the game gets there, they seem to have the ability to play that.
Yeah, and we're running out of time here, but I almost think that the injury to Simmonds and the fact that he came back with the bad wrist and couldn't really be that guy, mm-hmm, may have been a blessing in disguise to the Leafs, because the rest
force some people into that role. Yeah, you never want to be sitting back saying that's the guy who's going to do it. And
right,
that's the same with goal scoring.
It's not fair. Yeah, right.
Like Cole Caulfield, you go get the goal. That's you don't want your team doing that. Everyone, yeah, go get one.
Yeah, that's a tough spot to put everyone in. I think the Leafs understand that they've got the skill, and I think they have the swagger and the confidence in that skill.
Yeah.
If they bring that other aspect of the game, because we all know sacrifice plays in the postseason.
Yeah.
Like, you have got to want it, and you have got to give up certain things to go get it. And the Leafs haven't had that in the past.
Yeah, and there's no way through to the Stanley Cup without encountering a team that's going to put you in that situation.
Right.
You know, it might be Winnipeg or Montreal or some team that they can handle generally, but you don't get all the way through without it.
No, without a doubt. And that's the point of the postseason, is to make you do things that you don't do well.
Get uncomfortable.
And the Leafs haven't been able to do that thus far. We'll see if they do it this year. All right. Coming up on Sportsnet West, it is the Habs and the Flames. Big game. Hockey Central on Ontario, East, and Pacific. We will continue on Sportsnet 360, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, with NFL expert Michael Lombardi ahead of Thursday's NFL draft. Back in 60 seconds. Thank you, Mr. Bourne.
Anytime. Thank you.
Welcome back to Tim and Friends right here on Sportsnet. We are a couple of days away from what could be an historic NFL draft. The quarterbacks could go 1, 2, 3. The quarterbacks could go, depending on who you're listening to, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Here to help us sort through. They could go top 5 in 10 picks. I don't know. We're going to get Michael Lombardi on the show and try and sort through the poker game and the truth of it all. And he is a writer. He is hosting a podcast with Adnan Virk and also a former NFL GM. And Jesse, I think we're going to do a little smoke or fire with Mr. Lombardi if we haven't lost him permanently.
I can't wait for it.
In smoke or fire, what are we looking at when it comes to a draft? Are we looking at just spots, or are we talking a little bit about positional needs as well?
Definitely positional needs. The talk of this NFL draft is the top of the draft with the quarterback situation. Everybody's asking, who's it going to be? Is it going to be Trey Lance? Is it going to be Mac Jones? Is it going to be Justin Fields? So hopefully we get a little bit of an answer with respect to the quarterback situation from Mr. Lombardi, because that's the question that everybody wants to know. A lot of quarterbacks up for grabs in the draft.
Well, we have hooked back up with him here from the GM Shuffle pod. And as a writer with The Athletic is former NFL GM Michael Lombardi. Sorry about the snafu to start. Appreciate you doing this with us.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you. I appreciate it.
We give you the round of applause because we know you host a podcast with our friend Adnan Virk. Just got to ask, first question, do you get a word in?
Sometimes, but I love his stories and I learn a lot. And now that he's coming off the top rope at WWE, the man's expanded his game. I mean, I think it's great. I think it's awesome. And you know, there can't be a nicer person. You know, there's sometimes you meet people that seem nice on television and they're nicer in person, and I think Adnan would be that guy.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you joining us either way, even if you're lying about Mr. Virka.
No, I'm not lying.
No, not at all. Let's talk about this draft. All right, like, it seems like we are quarterback heavy, and every piece of ink that is dropped is on this quarterback crop. Is it worth it?
Well, I think it depends on where they go, right? So I think this is a draft where, you know, the Jets made a decision to trade Sam Darnold in for Zach Wilson. I think there's some debate whether that'll be worth it. We think Trevor Lawrence will certainly be worth it. I think Mac Jones going 3 to San Francisco with Kyle Shanahan will prove to be worth it because Kyle Shanahan does a great job of coaching the quarterback. Plus, he knows what he wants in that position, what he needs from that position, and what he expects from that position. So, you know, this is always a marriage between the coach and the scheme. Yeah. You know, I think we see that with Alex Smith. You know, when he spent 5 years in the NFL, he struggled. And then when he found Jim Harbaugh, he got better. And then when he found Andy Reid, he got even better. So a lot of this is predicated on who the coach is. And I think when the coach picks you, you got a really good chance to succeed.
Are we overdoing the quarterbacks because of how important the position is when the situation that they go to is almost as important as who the quarterback is?
No doubt. Look, here's the reality, okay? The greatest coach in terms of wins in the National Football League is a man by the name of Don Shula, who passed away last year, God rest his soul. Don Shula won more games than any coach in the league. He had Dan Marino playing quarterback, who's in the Hall of Fame. I cannot tell you, and without any doubt, Dan Marino would be the best quarterback in this draft if he came out. Dan Marino at the age of 24 until he turned 29 didn't make the playoffs with the Miami Dolphins with the greatest coach on the sideline. So it's more than the quarterback. It's more than being a Hall of Fame player. You need a team around you. And I think we miss that so often. We keep asking the question, can this guy take us to the Super Bowl? No, your team's got to take you to the Super Bowl. This guy's got to play well, but the team's got to take you to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, it's a lesson that we keep learning by watching the games and the seasons play out. But every time we come to a draft, it just seems like everyone is so seduced by that next quarterback prospect. So who is the player on the board that you believe should be valued more but maybe lost in this quarterback chatter?
Oh, I think that's an easy question. It's a great question. I think Sewell, the left tackle from Oregon. Here's a guy who not only is he going to be a really good left tackle, he's going to be a Pro Bowl left tackle. He's 19 years old. I mean, to find a young, athletic 19-year-old is hard to do. This guy didn't give up the sack in 900 snaps. I mean, for him to not be in this, he's the fifth pick overall by the Bengals. He should be the second pick in this draft. He's that good. He's the second best player. If you ask me of these 10 names, who could be Hall of Fame players, I would tell you Sewell and Trevor Lawrence, maybe Kyle Pitts. That would be my list.
Is Kyle Pitts, listen, I'm remarkably intrigued by him because when you look at the crop of tight ends in the National Football League, every year we've got one or two at the top, and then there's this huge drop-off, and it depends who you put in and when you put them in on their prime. But it seems like a position where you can really make hay if you get a top-of-the-line guy. Is Kyle Pitts that guy?
He is a top-of-the-line guy. Look, here's the reality. Football's a lot like chess. You want to, you know, to be a great chess player, you have to control the middle of the chessboard. To be a great offensive football team, you have to control the middle of the field. And the tight ends help you do that more than any position. And when you get a tight end who can contribute in the run game in terms of blocking, and then you get one who's a matchup nightmare for them. See, he's out there playing out. He's really playing X here. He's hard to cover. Yeah. Can't put a guy on him. The corner can't cover him. You know, so you've got a guy that can run down the seam like here in this video, and then he can make plays, and he challenges the middle of your defense with his size and with his speed. That's hard to do. It makes defensive coordinators have to play a step behind you. Do we play nickel against them? They'll run the ball on you. If you play base against them, they'll throw the ball on you. And the guy's really good in jump ball situations. So for me, this is a challenging player to take in terms of from a defensive standpoint.
Michael Lombardi joining us here on Tim and Friends. Okay, so last week we did a feature on how everyone lies to us at this time. And they lie to us because they're trying to set up the poker game that is the draft. So we do a little thing called smoke or fire where we try and figure out what's smoke and what's actual fire. Do you think you could help us out if Jesse Rubinoff does it for us? Awesome.
I'll give you the best shot. I'll give you my best shot.
Love it. Let's roll with it then. So I'm going to throw out a rumor, and if you don't mind, Michael, you just tell me if there's smoke or fire there, okay? So you said that Mac Jones, you expect him to go number 3. So where does that leave Ohio State's Justin Fields? If he falls out of the top 5, maybe a bidding war for teams trying to get into the latter half of the top 10. If Fields does slide a bit, NFL Network's Tom Pelissero linked Fields with the New England Patriots. Could bring him in to compete with Cam Newton, and we know Cam is a fan of Justin Fields from back in Fields high school days. Why don't we have a listen to their interaction from back in the day?
From high school?
Well, we have it. Yep.
The coaches.
Hey, listen, man. It's Cam Newton here. Hey, best player in high school football right here. If you're a high school player and you watching this, you know it's the truth. If you doggone a recruiter for anything, this the best thing any recruitment can get you right here.
Said former five-star himself.
I'm Cam Newton, and I approve this message.
So the question is, Michael, smoke or fire, Bill Belichick finds a way to end up with Justin Fields. Already has Cam Newton, but smoke or fire, the Pats end up with Fields.
You know, I think that's a little bit of smoke. I don't think that's real. I think that the one thing about the Patriots, their board is going to be set based on what they value. I think it's more smoke. I think if they were trying to get Justin Fields, they would try to make a move. I don't see that happening.
Love it. Let's move on to one of the best to ever do it at the wide receiver position, maybe on the move. Ian Rappaport says the Falcons could move Julio Jones before next season. Atlanta's new GM, Terry Fontenot, is trying to get out of cap hell and may feel as though Jones' recent injuries will diminish his on-field impact moving forward. Now, due to cap implications, Rappaport thinks that there's a deal it would go down after June 1st. So, smoke or fire, Julio Jones has played his last game with the Atlanta Falcons.
I think it's fire, and they've got to find the right trade partner. Certainly, Jacksonville could take him on. He's got $31 million coming to him in the next two seasons. 19 of that is guaranteed. So you got to find a team with that cap room. He's not going to redo his contract. He's not going to agree to a trade and redo his contract. So you got to find a team that has that cap room. Jacksonville has that cap room. Denver actually has that cap room. So I think they can move him. They're going to have to take less to get away from the contract than typically a player like Julio Jones would command. But he's 32 years old. He has had some injuries over the last two seasons. But I think there's a lot of fire there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how much do you think he's got left in the tank?
Well, I think if you can keep him healthy, he's got a lot left in the tank. The problem is that big if. You know, durability is as important as ability, and he suffered through some injuries. But he's still a top-level receiver. He averaged 15-1 a catch last year. 2 years ago, he averaged 14. He only had 9 touchdowns over the last two seasons. He's not had the ball in the end zone as much as you would think he would, but he's still a dynamic player.
Another intriguing spot is at number 6. The Miami Dolphins already got a King's ransom to move down from number 3 to 6, to say the least. With the quarterback frenzy early on, it means a significant offensive threat can fall their way. Pro Football Network's Tony Pauline says Miami's happy with where they are, knowing one of the top 3 receivers or freak of nature tight end. You guys already talked about it. Kyle Pitts will be there when they hit the podium. So smoke or fire, let's say Kyle Pitts will be a Miami Dolphin in Tua Tagovailoa's latest weapon.
You know, I think that's smoke. I think Pitts is going to go to Atlanta at 4. I think Ja'Marr Chase is a good possibility for Miami at 6, depending if the Bengals don't take him. The Bengals could take Sewell, which would be the smart play. But then why do we ever think the Bengals do something smart? I don't know. You know, so for me, that's would be, and I think Ja'Marr Chase would be the pick the Dolphins really wanted and coveted.
Do you think Miami is that close? Because it feels like, listen, over the last two seasons, it has felt at times like they're a really good team and it's same old Miami. What are they?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it's going to come down to Tua. You know, I kid on my podcast with Adnan. I say, we're not allowed to say a bad word about Tua. God forbid if you said a bad word about Tua. The guy averaged 5.5 yards per attempt on third down. Didn't throw the ball down the field. Only had 6 passes over 25 yards last year. I mean, he's got to play to a much higher level if Miami is going to improve. He's the key. Now, they put all their chips in the middle of the table, and they've gone all in on him. You know, I thought they might entertain a quarterback, whether it's Trey Lance, whether it's Justin Fields. I don't know, but they're not. So they're going for the skill. They signed Will Fuller, who's a dynamic player. They have Parker at receiver. They've got 2 good receivers. Gesicki's the tight end who could do some damage inside. They need somebody who can throw the football effectively like Fitzpatrick did when he relieved them.
One more for you. Just one more. Ian Rappaport also reported that the Vegas Raiders are doing extensive work on this year's quarterback class. They own the 17th pick, and none of the top 5 will still be on the shelf by then, we expect. So smoke or fire, the Raiders will target the second wave of quarterbacks like Kellen Mond or Kyle Trask.
I think that's smoke. I don't think they'll target that. Look, here's the reality. They're either going to have to sign Derek Carr to a 35 $36, $37, $40 million a year contract, or they're going to have to draft his replacement. It would be smart for them to draft their replacement. I mean, could I see them trading up to get Justin Fields? Could I see them trading up to get Trey Lance? Yeah, I could. Why? Because what happens is they can let Carr go, trade Carr for an asset, and have a young quarterback who's cap-friendly. The Carr contract is going to hinder what the Raiders do moving forward. So it's, how do you want to manage the team? How do you want to manage the game?
Such an interesting dilemma, because we've seen teams can take huge strides with quarterbacks on their rookie contract.
Yep.
And if they're able to do that, that could make the Raiders a real interesting team. Mike, this was fun. Thank you very much for doing it. Really appreciate the time.
Appreciate you. Anytime. Thank you.
There is Mike Lombardi, who was a GM in the league and now works on the GM Shuffle podcast with our friend Adnan Virk. Also, thanks to Jesse Rumidoff. He will be back. We'll do Last Call. We'll also do a little tip of the cap to our friend Brooke Henderson after the break here on Tim and Friends.
At 590.
Welcome back to Tim and Friends. Our Monday tip of the cap goes to the amazing Brooke Henderson. A 23-year-old from Smith Falls won her 10th career LPGA title on the weekend with a come-from-behind victory at the LA Open. Henderson already had the record for the most tournament wins by a Canadian golfer, man or woman. But check out this stat. Henderson won her 10th career LPGA event at the age of 23 years, 7 months, 14 days. Tiger Woods was 23 years, 6 months, and 5 days when he won his 10th career PGA event. Jesse Rubinoff stopping by for Last Call here on Tim and Friends. Is it already done that at 23 years old, Brooke Henderson is the greatest Canadian golfer of all time?
Yeah, I think so. She's been winning since 2015. On the open, she's 23 years old.
Yeah, and there was a pandemic
already. And there was a pandemic.
Like, she didn't play much.
She's 23. Think about how many titles she's going to be able to win. I mean, the LPGA Tour is extremely competitive. It's extremely competitive. But she's got 10 wins already. She's been winning since 2015. I think she's the best.
Yeah, and I think she just has that winner's attitude that you need in golf. Although, I feel like Corey's on his way. I feel like Connors is just
he's breakthrough again.
Yeah, he's a one win away from getting that swagger because he's constantly there because of how good a player he is.
Yeah, he's been up there for a month now, basically, and he's just got a breakthrough on the weekend.
Yeah, knock on wood, I hope he gets that breakthrough.
Me as well. Why don't we do some Last Call?
Let's do it, friend.
Today marks the 10th anniversary of one of the biggest goals in Vancouver Canucks history.
Yes, sir.
Alex Burrow's OT winner in Game 7 against the Blackhawks in the first round of the 2011 playoffs. It's known as the Slay the Dragon goal because Chicago had beaten the Canucks in each of the two previous postseasons. Of course, Vancouver would go on to reach the Stanley Cup final. Why don't we relive it? Here's how Burrow's goal sounded.
And he's dumped the puck back in. And 19 playoff games against Chicago. For Vancouver, it's a wonderful day for an exorcism.
Great call, Jimmy Houston.
Speaking of exorcisms, which current NHL team needs to slay the dragon? I mean,
I'm gonna give you the layup. I'll hit the chippy, and I'm gonna give you a curveball.
Okay.
The Toronto Maple Leafs in the first round need to slay the dragon, and there is without. Not only do they need to slay the dragon, but they need to change the narrative on their team, and that's what this entire year has been about: is attempting to change their narrative. And Saturday night against Winnipeg, we talked about it with Justin Bourne. That was the start. Like, what they showed in that game was this toughness that we will not be pushed around again in the postseason. I want to see it in sacrifice. I want to see it in toughness. And then let the skill eat. Let the big dogs eat. But also let the dog, the D-O-double-G's, eat as well. And I think the Leafs have a good mix of both. So we'll see if they do that. The curveball on who needs to slay the dragon. Tampa Bay. I want to see if they can do it again.
Ooh.
And listen, they were the Leafs before the Leafs were the Leafs. I want to see if there is this residue of championship that we see in every other sport on this Tampa squad. I think there's a little bit. Listen, they've already got the cup. Some people will put an asterisk beside. I won't, because of what they had to go through to get that cup. But there will be people that say, let me see you do it over the long haul.
Yeah.
And I think there'll be a little bit of pressure on Tampa from the inside too, to say that that wasn't just a one-off. That wasn't just this crazy pandemic shortened bubble year. We are legit best team in the NHL.
It's going to be a tough road for Tampa. They've been limping a little bit lately. It's going to be, that division is tough.
Just imagine they go out first round again.
Yeah.
It'll be exactly like we saw with the Washington Capitals, mm-hmm. where you got one and that's amazing, but
Kucherov coming back off the LTIR.
I got you.
It's going to help.
That was my curveball. There was a layup there. I was going to take it, but I wanted to give you a little something that I really want to see what kind of gumption Tampa shows up with this year.
Love it. Moving on to basketball, the Raptors host the Cavs tonight in Tampa. It's the first of five games for the Raps in the next 7 days. Today, Nick Nurse said he doesn't expect to have injured Chris Boucher back in the lineup, quote, anytime soon. So that's not great. The Raptors are currently two games back of the Wizards, who just don't lose for the final play-in spot in the East with 12 games remaining. Washington, they've won eight in a row. Do you think the Raps have a chance at catching them?
First off, what world do we live in where the two hottest teams in the East are the New York Knicks and the Washington Wizards?
It's so ridiculous. Like, watching the Raptors play the Knicks was absurd, because there was this energy in the building that you haven't seen in decades.
And there was
over a decade.
And there was only 4,000 people at Madison Square Garden to make you feel like that. Like, I have no idea what in the good name of Jeff Van Gundy's lid we're talking about when it's the Wizards and the Knicks, who are the two hottest teams in the East. The Boucher loss, if it's a while, it's a huge loss. And I don't think going into this season anyone would have thought that. But Chris Boucher is a huge loss, because there's no depth up front when it comes to matching up with guys. And listen, he's not going to body Julius Randle in any way, shape, or form, but he can upset him. He can disrupt him. Things like that matter. Size matters. I think we're going to see the Raptors struggle to catch the Wizards, but I also don't believe in the Wizards.
Tough schedule too for the Raps to close out the year. Like, you got Lakers, Clippers, Jazz, like a lot of
depends
those.
Depends what it
teams.
Means to those guys too.
Yeah.
Cuz it might
lucky.
Not mean that it could get lucky. Yeah.
As we talked about earlier,
or
plenty
unlucky,
of intrigue
depending on how you're looking at it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Plenty of intrigue surrounding what the 49ers will do with the number 3 pick in the NFL draft. Michael Lombardi thinks it'll be Mac Jones. It's widely expected that they will take a quarterback. Today, head coach Kyle Shanahan was asked if he could guarantee that incumbent starting quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo would still be on the roster after the draft.
I can't guarantee that anybody in the world will be alive Sunday, so I can't guarantee who will be on our roster on Sunday. So that goes for all of us.
Just a bizarre quote. What can you guarantee will happen by Sunday?
It is a bizarre quote. That's a bizarre way
of getting out from.
Yeah. Just, I can't believe you. You won't be dead by Sunday.
Just brutal.
Wow.
In a pandemic, too. Like, come on.
Why are they being so coy?
Because
are they worried?
We did a feature on this. We did a whole feature on the team's line.
I understand it, but it seems like everyone's set. It seems like the two teams. Do they think that the Jets might throw a curveball?
Potentially.
You traded up to get to this spot.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand why, unless they go completely off the board, and unless they're trying to do something that's completely off the board. But even then, with the first two picks set, I don't, like, it's not, you would think if they were being coy, they're going to trade down.
Mm-hmm.
But they traded up to get this spot.
It's just an NFL team being an NFL team before the draft.
Do they think if they talk up Mac Jones too much that the Jets will end up taking Mac Jones at 2?
I like that theory a lot.
Is that what they think?
Mac Jones can't go 2, man. Like, he's playing behind an NFL line in Alabama. Like, come on.
He's got, what, 2 receivers that'll go in the top 15?
Yeah.
Or the top 10?
A lot to be expected of Mac Jones. It's going to be tough for him.
All right.
Patrick Waugh is looking to make a return to the NHL.
What?
Waugh's new agent tweeted earlier today that he's
coach,
representing
right?
the Hall of Famer concerning NHL coaching and management opportunities. I should have started with that, but that's okay. If the Habs miss the playoffs this season, could there be an opening either coach or GM in Montreal.
Oh, how many times do we have to do this, Sebi? How many times do we have to talk about the Patrick Watt of the Montreal Canadiens as the coach? It's fun as hell, isn't it? You don't? Would you take him?
It's a deep breath.
Listen, if they do that, it's Marc Bergevin. Listen, we talked about desperation and bringing Cole Caulfield in. If they brought in Patrick Waugh, that would be the desperate move to take the attention away from Marc Bergevin and onto Patrick Waugh, because he would do that for anyone. All right, that does it for Last Call. Thank you, Jesse.
Thanks, Timmy.
Thanks to everyone who joined us. Sebastian Morin for all of his contributions today. Get the thumbs up from him. Thank you for watching. We will see you tomorrow on Tim and Friends and Sportsnet.